Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a political activist and a moderate Democrat from Los Angeles, California.
I'm DJ McGuire, an economics instructor, a veteran Republican activist until last year, and a rookie Democratic activist as of last month.
I'm Rebecca Kuschmider. I'm a freelance writer and liberal Democrat from Kensington, Maryland.
And I'm Helena Henry, an evangelical conservative, lawyer, and dog lover from Colleyville, Texas.
Okay, great. And we, together, are the More Perfect Union. The More Perfect Union can be found on iTunes, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Facebook, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios and commentary. And this week, we're featuring a guest commentary by journalist William Gleed titled Transcending the Trans Ban. It's a really good piece, so please look for that on our website. But we're going to talk, of course, about the story that everyone is talking about across the country and possibly around the world, the protest that led to violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. So obviously, you know, a horrible week in America. But what can we take away from this? Without recapping what happened, what can we learn from this incident about racism in America in the 21st century?
We have a lot of work to do. That's the first thing. A lot of the battles that white America thought were done and dusted will certainly have to be revisited and may actually have to be refought. As horrifying as the murder on Saturday was, what actually scared me more or deeper, and I say this as a white guy who grew up in Jersey, was the group that showed up with the tiki torches on Friday. Because to your typical white American, they looked quote unquote normal. You know, it was for those old enough to remember the Clean for Jean campaign in 1968, where the hippies shaved their beards and cut their hair and cleaned up their act, for lack of a better term, so that they could appeal to older voters to vote for Gene McCarthy over Lyndon Johnson. This was Clean for Gene's evil dark twin. And that's what really scared me. They looked quote unquote normal. And that tells us that this is a much deeper and much more insidious problem than we thought we had. And I would say my apologies to Kevin and Rebecca, but I'm going to ask that you allow me to bypass you because I want to go straight to I want to know what Helena thinks.
Sure, sure.
And I think we all need to know what she thinks.
Well, let me make clear that first, you know, as we all know, I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for African-Americans everywhere, people of color everywhere, so on and so forth. This reminds me of, I believe, an SNL skit with, I want to say it was Dave Chappelle, where white Democrats are watching the 2016 election returns and they have two black people over and they are shocked and dismayed to find out that Donald Trump won the election and grappling with the revelation that perhaps this is actually a racist country. And I'm not funny, so my retelling of it won't be funny. But Dave Chappelle's
just so you know, it was Chris Rock. But go ahead.
Okay. Oh well. Okay. This is terrible. No. They're not all the same to me. But I could have sworn it was Dave Chappelle. Anyway, he says essentially, like, you don't think, like, really, like, you just figured out, you know. And I don't mean that with the spirit of hostility that may sound like I do, but I think that there's sort of a there's a sense of perhaps progress in there being some mainstream recognition that things are not things may look different. You know, having Barack Obama serve in the White House makes it look different, but things are not different, and the hearts of people are not different. And the next thing I would say is, I think that the debates that are coming out of this incident are what results when a society and a culture really discards the idea of objective truth. We've had, you know, a lot of trouble in the last couple decades in particular with accepting that there's such thing as things that are inherently right and inherently wrong. And there's been a temptation to insist that there's no such thing as either. There is no inherently right. There is no inherently wrong. There's your truth. There's my truth, his truth, her truth, and whatnot. But I think the incidents like Charlottesville, show that that can't be the case. And we have to, at some point, decide as a culture what things are inherently acceptable and what things are inherently unacceptable. That's a different question, of course, from what the government should be involved in. But that was my initial instinct from the incident.
And speaking of instincts, actually, you were as right as I was. It was both Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle. So there you go.
Good. Thank you. I was horrified that I had just committed.
No,
you, know,
you got it. You got
a
it.
Previous error.
Thank God for Google.
Calling all black comedians the same. Wonderful. There you go.
But back to what's really important, which is our discussion of Charlottesville, which I keep mispronouncing. So here's my question about it. Everybody knows that white nationalism is pervasive in America these days. And we know, especially those of us who are a little bit more liberal, but I'm not saying that you guys don't as well, that white nationalism is the new word for racist, for white supremacist, for the KKK, whatever other terms there are out there. But I wonder whether the term white nationalism, which has now become the catchphrase, isn't part of the problem, because Trump has almost legitimized white nationalism as just preserving our culture. And I wonder whether the working class white trucker in Cayuga County might just hear the words white nationalism and think, hey, that sounds good to me. It sounds like all American apple pie. That's the way it should be.
Well, first of all, it's Cuyahoga County.
Yeah, and it's Dave Chappelle County. So
yeah, it's Dave Chappelle County, which is next door to Chris Rock County. They collaborate sometimes to make things that are very, very funny. I think language is important. I think this white nationalism that sort of falls into, God, I remember years ago, Newt Gingrich put out a list of phrases that Republicans should hammer on. And it was always things like liberty and freedom. And white nationalism does sound like one of those things.
Right.
It sounds like a good thing. Like, yes, we are pro-Americans. We are, you know, what is it? Free, white, and 21. Wasn't that that was a phrase from old movies, you know, indicating a certain level of autonomy. And so maybe it does have a positive connotation for some people. But on the other hand, we've gone so far with saying, no, you know, don't call people Nazis unless they're actually Nazis, that now it's kind of hard to tell who's really a Nazi and who's just a white nationalist and who needs to be punched in the head and who doesn't.
Well, first of all, when they are wearing the Hakenkreuz as an armband and when they have shirts quoting Adolf Hitler on the back, they're Nazis. That's easy.
So I should punch those guys.
Yes. Yeah. And if you don't want to use the term Nazi, if you want to use the phrase I'm going to come up with, which is Al KKKKita, you know, I'm sure that works just as well. But no, white nationalist is not good, and it's not good for two reasons. One, it is another example of an attempt to erase people of color from the American past, the American present, the American future. The other thing it does is it makes what we used to call ethnic whites back in the day forget their actual ethnic history. When I was growing up, I was Irish American first before I was white. And for German Americans and Polish Americans and Russian Americans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, unless you are a WASP, you have had some sort of history of marginalization in this country. And it was really, I would say, probably that my journey, if you will, on recognizing or beginning to recognize, because I don't think I finished the journey yet, what people of color have gone through and are still going through. That really began when I took a deeper look into what Irish Americans suffered in the 19th century. And I said, okay, this is what my people went through, for lack of a better term, and it still bothers me to read it today. You know, if I have trouble watching Gangs of New York and Michael Collins, forgive me for bringing you into this, Helena, but I can't even imagine how hard it was for Helena, for example, to sit through 12 years a slave, if she even could do that.
Yeah.
So that,
you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, DJ, because I recall being as young as 9 And in public school, I too grew up in New Jersey, and feeling a tremendous sense of pain and shame and isolation when we would go through slavery and Reconstruction in history. And, I grew up in a predominantly white area. And to internalize those feelings as a child and then see the trauma of it sort of replayed both in entertainment and also in the news, it is an interesting experience. I, unlike you, I loved Gangs of New York because it had Leonardo DiCaprio in it. And
it was a great film. Very good film. It was right. Difficult for me to watch.
It was the opposite of difficult for me. Yeah. I'll put it that way. But
I feel that way about Leo too.
Saying only 1997 Leo, not like 42-year-old Leo who hangs out with 21-year-old models and refuses to settle down and get a wife. But I understand and I appreciate the sentiment, DJ.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I'll say again, nowhere's near comparing my experience, but like you, DJ, I identified as a Jewish American more than a white person. So, there you go.
So this is part of what I think contributes to the problem. And I want to be very careful here because I don't want to overstate or miscommunicate what I'm saying. I think that identity is essential. And I do not buy the argument that individual cultures and religions and ethnicities and whatnot should be erased in favor of an American people. But I do think that there is such a thing as hyper identification, if you will, where instead of appreciating the policies, the systems and the mores that are good for the country collectively or good for society collectively, we tend to think of how we experience things as a fill in the blank American, whether that be an Italian American, an African American, et cetera, and so on. And so I do think that there's an opportunity here to assess what are the ways in which identification is helpful and contributes to a richer and a more diverse culture, and what are the ways in which it can be harmful.
Mm.
Well, it's the difference between being part of a community and being in a silo.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask this. Everybody in the news and probably everybody in their own individual conversations the last few days have been talking about the scourge of the white nationals and the Nazis and any other labels that we want to use there, and blaming this entire event on them. And obviously they do shoulder certainly the bulk of the blame. But what have liberals done to help create this atmosphere? I'm just wondering, do we only blame it on the group that promoted the violence, or is there something else happening? Frankly, this is sort of what Donald Trump said the day of the attack, although I was not happy with his statement, but he did allude to that this is a problem that has more than one side and it goes back more than 8 or 10 years. I'll start with the other liberal here, Rebecca. Do we have some responsibility to shoulder here?
I read a wonderful article, and it might have come out of Harvard. It was some scholarly article right after the election that talked about the white working class and the way they view people and what slots they categorize people in. And we're talking about people who have sort of a corporate structural view of America. And the argument that was being made was that people who are below management level hate middle managers,
right?
Because all they do is come in and tell you when you're wrong, but they admire CEOs because success breeds respect. And Donald Trump is a CEO. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton look like middle management. And I think that's something we never quite understood. The liberal elitist point of view is sort of middle managey. We're like you, but we're slightly better than you, and we're going to tell you why what you're doing is wrong. And that attitude, I could see how that would rub someone the wrong way over the long term. And so we maybe haven't listened in the way we should. At the same time, just because you're being rubbed wrong by a particular group of people doesn't mean that the logical next step is to become a Nazi.
Right.
That's really almost never the logical next step.
And I would take what Rebecca said a step further. You know, my instinct, my initial reaction to the question is don't blame the victim. And I might be sensitive to this because this is also the week of the Taylor Swift sexual assault trial, where my BFF Taylor really held her own under cross-examination.
Held her own.
Right,
that
right.
That girl spoke for all of us.
Absolutely. So my instinct is, you know, what have liberals done to you know, the question was create this atmosphere, but essentially provoke this. My answer is nothing, right, for the reasons that Rebecca said. The response is not tiki torches with citronella. But also, the reality is they're not, this particular incident in Charlottesville was not really reacting to liberalism.
Right.
It was not reacting to, you know, a set of policies and ideology, one with which, you know, I personally disagree in a lot of points. It wasn't reacting against, you know, big government and legislation and whatnot. It was reacting against the existence of other types of people who are not white, and their presence and participation in American society. And there's nothing that liberals have done to contribute to that atmosphere in a way that, you know, I think would, and not that the question is trying to place blame, but in a way that I think justifies blaming liberals at all.
DJ, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't see anything where you could place blame on the left or the center left for what happened out of here. The only thing, the ostensibly the reason they showed up, the reason the Nazis showed up, was to defend a Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville, which the local city council wanted removed. And as a Yankee turned Southern Unionist, I am all the more willing to see Confederate statues removed from public display, because it venerates an attempt to break up the Union and keep millions of people enslaved. So, you know, I don't think liberals have anything to, I don't think there's any blame that should be heading their way. To the extent that the left and center left may want to look and see, okay, how can we minimize the impact of this sort of thing and prevent the emboldening of these people from things like Trump's election? That comes down to certain political strategies. And again, that's not a, oh, you did something wrong, you are to blame for this. It's a matter of, if you did certain things, if you address the concerns of different people you're not used to, you know, people, frankly, like me, I am a very odd duck in the Democratic Party. I recognize that. I know that. But it's going to be voters like me, voters who are conservative on economic issues, who are appalled at what is going on at what happened in Charlottesville over the weekend. We are the voters who are most likely to help the Democrats build the electoral majorities they need to stop folks like Trump from getting elected and stop these people from being emboldened. That's not a blame thing. That's just a matter of, this is what you can do to prevent shit like this from happening again. Pardon my language. And I think that's about as far as we can go in that. I wouldn't blame the left or center left for anything. I would say, take the right lessons learned, and you can prevent this happening again.
Okay, and so we've answered that question. And then the flip side of it is, what have the conservatives done to create this atmosphere? Now, obviously, you know, Trump hired Bannon, and we'll put that on a separate shelf because that's too easy. But if we take that out of the equation, has the Republican Party, do they bear some responsibility for this?
So I'm going to answer this by segregating the Republican Party from conservatives in America. And I'll do that because I think that the Trump issue, for me personally, and I'm sure for others, has created an identity question in terms of what does conservative mean. The Republican Party at this point, you know, DJ calls it big government for white people. I agree. There's not much I can say that's positive, so I'll be nice and say nothing at all. I think that the party needs a reckoning sooner rather than later. But in terms of what conservatives have done, I think that people have intentionally overlooked, underestimated, silenced themselves from and insulated themselves from the problems and the troubles that plague people who are different from them. And it's unacceptable and it's inexcusable. And one area that I'm going to point a very large finger at is the evangelical leaders in this country who have hitched themselves to the Trump wagon and who have legitimized and given the Bannon Trump administration the imprimatur of legitimacy in their endorsement of him and their support of him. And, you know, I do want to relay a quote from an evangelical conservative pastor in Texas, Matt Chandler, which I think should be the official position of conservatives, of Christians, of anyone who identifies as culturally Christian, not Christian, Jewish, anything else. And it has not been the approach of James Dobson and people who are sitting at the right hand of Trump. And that quote is that white supremacy and the alt-right is incompatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is evil and from the pit of hell. You cannot call Jesus king and identify as a white supremacist or support that ideology. And it needs to be called out for what it is, bigotry, racism, and hatred. And you can't attach the name of Jesus to that. He goes on to joke that white supremacists wouldn't want to hang out with Jesus anyway because he's brown, and that heaven is essentially hell for white supremacists. Heaven is a, you know, collection of people of all races and backgrounds and ethnicities and whatnot bowing down to the same king. It is literally the antithesis of what white supremacy and the alt-right is about. But American Christianity and American conservatives have completely failed to acknowledge this and to do their part to counter it. And I think that's really where a lot of the blame lies. There's a limit to what the government can do, and we can talk about this in a different conversation about government speech and or how government can limit speech or how they can't. But this is where social cues and what is deemed acceptable in society comes in. And conservatives have failed to sufficiently signal that this kind of ideology is simply not acceptable and not welcome in any sort of public sphere.
Okay.
I think that goes back, Helena, to what you were saying about the idea of absolute rights and absolute wrongs and, you know, the both sidesism that we saw, particularly in the 2016 election, where we were giving legitimacy to conspiracy theorists, to fringe perspectives like this white supremacy ideology, and tried to put it on the same level as more humanitarian perspectives.
And since now Helena was kind enough to avoid criticizing the Republican Party, I was a Republican activist in Virginia for some 20 years, so I have a bit more knowledge on the subject here locally, and I am much more willing to castigate people who deserve it here. The fact of the matter is, I saw throughout much of last year, frankly, when as Trump was moving forward and scooping up delegates and pushed Marco Rubio out of the race and pushed everybody out of the race except really Ted Cruz and John Kasich, there were quote-unquote moderate Republicans who routinely would say, some privately, some openly, well, you know, Trump may be weird, he may be strange, and he may be, you know, he may have a bad odor to him, but Ted Cruz is the real problem. And that, frankly, annoyed the hell out of me. It was utterly ridiculous. You know, Ted Cruz had no problem calling out domestic terrorism for what it was. He had no problem calling out racism for what it was in his statement. He did more in two paragraphs than Donald Trump did all day Saturday. And yet somehow these people who call themselves establishment Republicans, who call themselves moderate Republicans, who call themselves sensible Republicans, you know, and not just in Virginia. I mean, it was Bob Dole. It was John Boehner. It was Peter King on Long Island. They all said, oh, well, yeah, Trump's kind of weird, but Cruz is the really scary guy who you don't want. That's a load of BS. That's number one. Number two, you have a lot of people in the party who knew this was a problem and who recognized that these were not desirable people. But they basically kept their mouths shut and said, you know, we're not, basically told themselves to other people, we're just going to leave this alone and we're not going to call those folks out until the next election is over because we want their votes. And in Virginia, where there's an election every year for either a state or federal office because of the way our alignment is, it basically meant this issue was never addressed. I mean, you had a candidate for governor essentially the local equivalent of mayor, for those of you who don't live in Virginia, leading protests and marches in Charlottesville to defend the Confederate statue that I talked about. And in some cases, he actually, if memory serves, he actually walked with some of these clowns, hopefully not recognizing who they really were. He came 1% short of actually winning the Republican primary for governor in this state. That's a very serious problem. The Republicans nationally, and particularly the Republicans in Virginia, have let this cancer grow within them. And when I was a Republican, I was just as guilty as they are. I don't want people to think that, oh, I'm castigating these people and I'm blameless. All right. I was a part of this. I had the beam in my eye as much as they did. And just because the scales fell from my eyes last year does not absolve me for everything that happened up until that point. But the Republicans as a whole have let this cancer grow. And now it is up to them, if they want to be a viable party in the 2020s and the 2030s, to completely excise it and accept that they may have to lose elections for the next 3 to 4 to 8 to 10 years in order to get that trust back in the American people. Because right now, they don't deserve it. And for my role in making that happen, I feel very guilty right now.
What you're describing, DJ, reminds me of the Jerry Sandusky situation at Penn State, where everyone in the football program knew, to one degree or another, that there was this cancer among them, this man who was a child molester. And they kept finding ways not to address the problem until they had to. And when they did, when they finally did have to, it was catastrophic. It was the downfall of Joe Paterno, who was probably otherwise a good man. It put a taint on the college for many years. They had to suffer many sanctions in their athletic program. They had to vacate wins and championships in their past because of what they did. And that seems like what could potentially happen to the Republican Party here, that when they are finally forced to address the deep wrongs inside their party, it could be catastrophic.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me ask this, and I'll start with the attorney here, because Helena, you've studied the Constitution as much, if not more, than anyone else here. You know, the Constitution talks about freedom of assembly, but the Constitution only guarantees the right to peaceable assembly. And it's become clear to me, and probably to everyone, that these groups may not be capable of peaceable assembly. So do we really still need to guarantee the right of assembly to hate groups?
So there's an assembly question, but there's also a speech question. And without getting too in the weeds here and putting everyone to sleep, the way that this is handled under your First Amendment is the government cannot restrict speech based on viewpoint. They can only do so based on content. And what that means is, for example, there could be a restriction that says that nobody can talk. Well, I don't know if there could be, but go with it for a second. Let's say there's a restriction that says nobody can talk about race, right? It doesn't matter if you're talking about race from a Black Lives Matter perspective or from an alt-right perspective. No one can talk about that race. That would be a content-based restriction. What would be a viewpoint-based restriction, and what is impermissible under the Constitution, is you can't talk about white supremacy. So if we want to live in a world where Black Lives Matter can come and assemble and speak in public places without government censorship, we have to live in a world where, the alt-right can do so as well. The peaceably assemble question is different because, I hate to say this, and I find the alt-right movement, white nationalism, abhorrent, as Matt Chandler says, demonic, comes from the pit of hell, etc. But I don't know that it could be said across the board categorically that all alt-right movements and protests are incapable of peaceably assembling. And so you're going to have trouble really getting around trying to exclude one particular group from a constitutional perspective because of these viewpoint protections that exist in our jurisprudence. That being said, this is where I think society has to step up to the plate. And I think that we also need to acknowledge that there's a limit to what government can do. And if you look at First Amendment jurisprudence, it is so complicated. The doctrines things are really, you know, nuanced and the distinctions are fine. And so we have to at some point say there's a role for us to engage with one another as citizens and to send messages without relying on the government to do the censorship for us.
And I think that's what happened a bit in Charlottesville with when the counter protesters heard what was going to happen and they just made a point of showing up.
Absolutely.
And the fact that the assembly became non-peaceable is something that only can be ascertained in the moment.
Well, yeah, but if you look at how they showed up.
80% armed.
Yeah.
In terms of this sort of thing, if a city, you know, is looking at a permit issue or something like this, and if they come to the conclusion, and if they have good reason to believe it, that the group that is asking to march peaceably will not in fact march peaceably, but bring violence with them. And I don't mean heckler's veto violence, because that's not really something that a group can control. But I mean, it's clear that when they come to march and quote, speak peacefully, they're not actually looking to speak peacefully, but they're looking to hurt people on the way. Does the locality, my impression would be that a locality then would have the power to say, well, wait a minute, we don't really think that you are in the best interest of peace for our city, and we are not going to allow you to do that. Does a locality actually have the power to do that under First
Amendment? So my understanding, and I could be wrong here because I, you know, this isn't my area of expertise. My understanding is yes, but again, I think it's very, very difficult. It's a high bar, particularly because when you're talking about the First Amendment, you're talking about what's known as a fundamental right, and government action that impedes or infringes upon that right has to meet what's or survive what's known as strict scrutiny. My point is just it's complicated, and I don't think that we should put too much stock in the idea that the answer is to simply not allow these types of protests from the alt-right, particularly because I've seen some reports that say that after Charlottesville disbanded, there were groups of folks with their tiki torches who went out to black neighborhoods to identify people, you know, that they could, I assume, harass at a minimum. And, you know, this behavior, it can't be suppressed. It doesn't really matter if you allow for assembly, if you don't, if you have viewpoint restrictions, if you don't. And this is where we'll get to some differences in how we view humanity. But if we accept for a moment that there have always been, and there will always be until, you know, Jesus comes back, dark, deep and broken strains in mankind, that infect society and that affect how we interact with one another, then we come to accept that the answer here isn't about the freedom of assembly or limitations of the First Amendment. It's how do we contend with the reality that there is evil in the world? And to me, getting back to the objective truth debate that we had earlier, the answer starts there. We come to a place of society where we finally accept there are such things. There is such a thing as truth, and there are things that are inherently wrong, and there are things that are inherently right. And we all may disagree on where the line is, but we have to at least be playing on the same chessboard, so to speak.
Yeah, but okay, so let's follow up on that. Let's say that we accept, and I agree with you, that there is inherent evil in the world, and there are ideas that are inherently bad. But you're saying we still have to give them a platform, and we have to allow them to protest or have these events. Well, if we're going to acknowledge that evil exists, why are we giving it a platform?
So what we could do, right, is we could have content restrictions. We could say no one talks about race. Black Lives Matter doesn't get to get up. You know, a pan-Asian group that wants to talk about, you know, Asian interests doesn't get to get up and speak. No one gets to do that. So here you've got a way. What is the value of having a public square that doesn't allow for all right views to be expressed, but also at the same time excludes other viewpoints that we may want to have in our national dialogue, like a Black Lives Matter or something like that? So there are ways to do it. The problem is it's just not good.
Why can't we just do it on Facebook? The worst that people could do there is block each other. There are no rocks thrown on Facebook. There are no cars running down the street on Facebook. Of course, I'm being facetious.
If you look at, you know, the female journalists involved in Gamergate and the way that that went from online to in their real lives rather quickly, I think we can agree that Facebook can quickly turn into, you know, live threats without too much difficulty.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So that brings me to another question that I had for everybody. I've thought about a lot of aspects of what happened yesterday. To my knowledge, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I know DJ will, this is the this is the first, what I'll call, major domestic terror attack that involved a car, much as we've seen a couple of times in Paris and in Belgium. There's been situations where drivers have lost control of their cars and run down people in the United States. I do believe this is the first time that a mass attack was engineered with a car here. Is this going to change the way Americans, you know, is this going to change us the way 9/11 did? Are we going to have barriers every place now? You know, my follow-up question is going to be, Rebecca, would you take your kids to a political event, knowing that something like this now is in the zeitgeist?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, I'm not sure that I would take my kids anymore. They're teenagers. And after yesterday, I'm not sure I would.
You know, when early this year, when I started going to events, I live right outside D.C., so I have a lot of opportunities to assemble peaceably. All the assemblies I've been to have been peaceable. I recognized that if I keep going to these events, there are a number of outcomes where people could get hurt. And I took a CPR class and a first aid class so that I could be a first responder, in a very small way, if that happened. And I understood at a very basic level that this was always possible. But I was thinking more in terms of sunstroke, dehydration, than
low blood sugar.
Yeah, you know, than a schmuck in a Dodge plowing into a crowd. I have never taken my children to any sort of protest, but on the other hand, I know people who took their kids, especially to the Women's March the day after the inauguration, and they found it to be a really enriching experience for kids. So I think I would be very careful about how I picked and chose those things.
So I think that it does change America. I don't think it changes it on the scale of 9/11, but what it does is it reveals that the sense of safety that those of us who don't live in a major metropolitan area feel is not justified. You know, this says more about my neuroses and anxiety than it does about anything real. But so I lived in New York for many years. And one of the reasons that I gleefully fled from New York City was not having to ride the subway, because I was convinced that it was simply an eventuality that there would be a terror attack on the New York City subway. And I was going to do everything I could to make sure I was not on it when that happened. Living in Colleyville, Texas, I certainly feel less of an imminent threat than you do in New York. But when you see something happen in Charlottesville, what it reminds you is that you can't sort of select out of being within the radius of evil. And, you know, I don't know that I would take my kids to anything. I don't know that I would take, well, when I say kids, I mean my dog. I don't know that I would take my dog to anything. She doesn't like crowds, so it probably works out for the best. But it does. It changes, you know, your risk calculation. You have to assess, is it worth it? You know, do you weigh the possibility of having an enriching experience against the likely cons, which exceed, you know, sunstroke and low blood sugar? I don't know.
But I mean, but also the idea of geography being destiny in these things, Oklahoma City,
yeah,
Columbine,
absolutely. Yeah,
Newtown, Connecticut. These are not major metropolitan areas in the way New York or LA are. The terrible things can happen anywhere. So, and I understand the fixation of, oh, Jesus Christ, there is going to be a terror attack on this subway. But I live 10 miles from Ground Zero. And if Kim Jong-un decides to bomb the East Coast, I can only put my head between my legs and kiss my ass goodbye.
Speaking of which, it looks like his capabilities are not limited to the East Coast. I've seen reports he can hit LA, Denver, that they've been able to shrink the nukes to put them on the ICBMs and get as far as they need to go. So now nowhere is safe.
Here's the good news. If we can avoid him launching his missiles for another 6 months, he'll actually be able to circle the planet and blow himself up.
Yay. So the answer is...
The best idea I've heard all week.
The answer is I'm building a bomb shelter. Everyone, y'all are welcome to come join for a reduced fee. And, you know, maybe we can wait out the apocalypse that seems to be coming.
Well, I want to throw something in on the subject of bomb shelters. This is a little side dance, but maybe it's not. I am old enough to remember the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. I was 6 or 7 years old then. My family had a bomb shelter in our basement. And I'm not talking about a little mud, you know, shack. This was a real bomb shelter with cinder block walls, 2 reinforced doorways. You had to go through one and then you had to go through a second one. We had food in there. We had clothes, beds. There were air filters that we would have to use. So imagine growing up with that in your basement.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember coming up with a plan for if the bomb dropped, how I would get from my middle school back to my house. I thought perhaps I could hold my breath, the 8 blocks, and get there in time to save my pets. But I may have been a bit overconfident in my abilities.
I live in the one part of the country that the Soviets, when they were around, and I guess the Russians still do, targeted before Washington, D.C., and that's the Hampton Roads area because of the multiple military facilities here. The joke always was, you know, what's going to happen Washington is when Washington gets hit with a nuke. And the joke was, well, we don't care. We'll already be dead. It's a little different because we're not really sure if Kim Jong-un can hit Hampton Roads yet.
Everybody knows that among the places that he probably can or very soon will be able to hit is Los Angeles. And I had to have the talk this week with my 16-year-old daughter. I had to have that talk. She brought it up.
Are you moving?
Well, you know, eventually I'd like to. I live 30 miles north of Los Angeles. And so my fear is that
you've been sitting in traffic since the 1980s.
Yes. Yes, I have.
You're actually doing this from your car.
I live just far away that I'll probably get hit because his aim probably isn't that good. I have to figure that they probably have a 30 mile adjustment on their accuracy. But, you know, it's very possible that if he did. Well, first of all, it's not going to happen. But if there were some kind of a nuclear exchange and he did hit Los Angeles, you know, we probably wouldn't be killed again if it was an accurate shot. But we'd have to deal with, you know, do you stay where you are? Do you flee? What will the roads be like? What would the radiation fallout area be like? All these questions came up in this conversation with my daughter this week, and I couldn't believe I was having this conversation.
It's crazy. I will say, I can believe it. I have been talking with friends. This is something to be terrible to be right about, and I hate to gloat over it, but I'll gloat. I've been talking with friends about North Korea and insisting, you know, at lunch, at dinner, wherever anyone would listen, that North Korea was a problem for like a year. Yeah. And all of a sudden, now it's in the news, and now people are, you know, not acknowledging I was right, but getting close to it. So I have, you know, again, in my neurotic tendencies, essentially living and thinking out what are the implications of this for a long time. And I think the answer might be relocate now. Go somewhere that's like economically meaningless. I don't know, Brownsville, Texas, something like that. No offense to anyone from Brownsville. And you know, set up your life.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was listening to, should I admit to listening to podcasts that aren't ours?
Yes.
Should I acknowledge? I think I was actually listening to This American Life, and they were talking to an expert on North Korea. And Kim Jong-un is right on schedule. 10 years ago, they were saying, yeah, within 10 years, he's going to have nuclear capabilities. And he does. It's like the intelligence and technology analysts whose job it is to know this stuff actually knew what they were talking about. And we all chose not to worry about it until we had to worry about it.
And this is why I am just thrilled that Trump is at the helm of this ship. There's
nobody, a steady hand.
Nobody I would want more.
Yep. Nobody brings the fire and the fury like our golfer in chief. He brings it right from Bedminster.
When you started saying nobody brings the fire, I thought you were quoting Hamilton. But I realize it's bringing the thunder.
Now you were saying that tongue in cheek, but did you folks hear the statement from the president of Guam or whatever he is, the governor of Guam, whatever they call the leader? He actually was saying, I couldn't be happier that Donald Trump is the person who is protecting us. He is the man that I want there. I feel more safe now than I ever had with another American president. Can you believe that?
Wait, he said that?
Yes.
That was real?
Yes.
You sure Andy Borowitz didn't say it? I had not heard that quote. I will have to go research.
Yeah, go look at his statement that he made, and it's on video. You can hear him say it.
The governor is a Republican.
Is he hoping that the president will build a hotel in Guam?
Yeah. Well, Trump said that this will be good for tourism. So,
can you believe
enjoy.
That? Honestly, I think that means he had never actually heard of Guam before. And he's like, hey, nobody knows this place exists and all publicity is good.
Right. I do like the name of a hotel called the Ground Zero. I think that would be great.
It should be noted that the governor of Guam is also a Republican, so that was probably some partisan BS he was spewing. The thing that just drives me nuts about this is so many people in Washington were raising the alarm about this in the 1990s. And this was something that Bill Clinton kicked under the rug, that George W. Bush swept under the rug. I actually like the fact that former President Obama basically ignored the whole thing, because that's really the only thing. Because if you don't ignore them, you essentially give them concessions. But the problem is, this is a regime that knows full well it has the full backing of the Chinese Communist Party and the cadres that run the regime in Beijing, or as I call it, Zhongnanhai, which is the Chinese Kremlin, because no one has actually forced Beijing to accept any consequences. Is it really a coincidence? Is the Chinese government really so lucky that North Korea launches its first long-range ICBM test on July 4, less than 3 weeks after Beijing finds itself in two different border disputes, one with Bhutan over a road that they want to build at Doklam, and the other in the South China Sea, where they claim everything in their field of vision, where Vietnam was doing oil drilling because, well, you know, Vietnam claims a large chunk of the South China Sea too. And yet nobody notices, oh, by the way, less than a month after China has two major border disputes, their North Korean ally fires off an ICBM and distracts everybody's attention. I mean, North Korea is the dead cat in world diplomacy. If China has a problem, they throw North Korea on the table and go, oh, look, there's a dead cat, people. You know.
So wait, I understand intellectually what you're saying, but I'm not sure I logically buy it. Are you saying that somehow China engineered this so that they could create a distraction?
It wouldn't surprise me if they did. And whether they did or not, it is part of the larger problem in that the Chinese government has never suffered any consequences for this. You know, everybody talked about the recent vote for UN sanctions as if it was unprecedented and it never happened before. China has allowed four other versions of sanctions to pass the UN Security Council: 2006, 2009, 2013, 2016. They don't veto sanctions from the UN. They violate sanctions from the UN. They just go around them and pretend they don't actually exist. The simple fact of the matter is, in my opinion, okay, fact and opinion don't work. Let me rephrase that. In my opinion, Washington needs to hold Beijing accountable for what their ally does. You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kevin. John F. Kennedy didn't say, if Fidel Castro launches a missile, we're going to incinerate Cuba and bury it and sink it below the Caribbean Sea. John F. Kennedy said, anything that Cuba does, we will hold the Soviet Union responsible. It focused the Soviet Union's attention. It focused Khrushchev's attention. And it helped avert a war and come and approach some sort of diplomatic solution. No one has done that with Beijing. In my opinion, if North Korea fires another missile in the air, we fire a few missiles at the Spratly Islands. China doesn't really own those anyway. They just claim them. Six other countries claim parts of the Spratly Islands. They're islands in the South China Sea, for those of you who don't know. But the Chinese government has seized a bunch of them and are building military establishments and various other things that the other six countries, Vietnam, Brunei, Taiwan, the Philippines, there are two others that I forget, are very upset about. So if North Korea is going to splash a missile near Guam, maybe we splash a missile near the Spratly Islands. Maybe we even hit an uninhabited part of the Spratly Islands. The point is,
I mean, you know a lot more about all of these geopolitical issues than I do. I'm not going to pretend that I can match you in that kind of knowledge, DJ, but just strategically, that seems like possibly the worst thing we could do, because essentially what you're saying is we should turn this into a conflict, a crisis, not between us and North Korea, but between us and China.
That's what it already is. I'm saying we acknowledge that's what's actually happening.
Ooh,
now, if you don't want to fire missiles at the Spratlys, that's fine. There are plenty of other things we could do. We can grant Taiwan diplomatic belligerent status, which sounds really nasty, but what it really means is we elevate the Taiwanese government, the elected democracy, to more than just a Chinese province in international diplomacy. We can be very serious about economic penalties on Chinese leaders and the Chinese government. We can provide logistical support for Vietnam when they do the next time they try their oil drilling. They suspended it because the Chinese scared them into backing down. We can provide logistical and military support for India in their battle with China over the Doklam area, because India is sticking up for Bhutan right now. We can say to the Chinese, okay, you're going to use your ally to scare the hell out of us. We're going to work with our allies to scare the hell out of you too, because you're the problem, not Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-il is your dog. Get your dog off our lawn or we're going to get serious.
Okay. I'm going to, since we're throwing out potential responses now to, let's say, some missiles shot at Guam, I'm going to put out my own. I'm going to call this the Trump doctrine. I think what we should do if they actually shoot missiles at Guam is Trump should thank them for all the money that we're going to save for not having to be a protectorate of Guam anymore.
Now, I have a friend who's been saying for a while that we could avoid most of the problems with Kim Jong-un just by bringing him to the United States and setting him up with the lifestyle of a B-list rapper. Like if we could fix him up to be basically like Tyga, maybe give him a Kardashian or two and some cars, he might totally forget this whole homicidal dictator thing and chill out a little bit.
Okay, so listen, we've talked about some morose subjects, and I think we were able to keep it really well balanced considering. But let's end with some cotton candy, some political cotton candy. The FBI shows up at Paul Manafort's house sometime between 2 and 6 in the morning.
And they showed up at his bedroom door.
And yeah, somehow he's banging on his bedroom door. They still haven't explained how that happened, which I love it. I mean,
like the housekeeper let him in or something.
Yeah, it's sort of like SEAL Team 6 showing up in, you know, the third floor of Osama's house. But so, first of all, wasn't that grand? Wasn't that great that they did this to this man? Because even if he has nothing to hide, he still deserves that. he still deserves, you know, a full body, you know, cavity search. But what does this mean if they did find something on him that is potentially criminal, you know, evidence against him? Is Paul Manafort going to fold?
Well, Mueller is sending a strong message. And sometimes, I don't know that this is what's happening for sure in the Manafort investigation, but sometimes what they'll do is they'll find something for an unrelated matter, but something that's bad and has some pretty significant criminal consequences nonetheless, yes, and will use that as leverage to get someone to talk and cooperate. So I think what's happening is here is he's being a boss. That's what he's doing. He's sending a very strong message about how serious this is, how serious he is, and how he's going to pursue it. And people are going to, you know, Trump is going to find out who his allies are very, very quickly.
I think he already knows. Right. I mean, I'll throw out.
Paul Manafort isn't one.
Well, here's my take on it. You know, in Watergate, you had people like G. Gordon Liddy, Howard Hunt, the other burglars, Haldeman and Ehrlichman. They were all, Coulson, they were all willing, more or less, to go to prison to take a bullet for their president. In Iran-Contra, Ali North, and DJ, maybe you'll remember the guy that was above him. He was also a military guy.
John Poindexter.
John Poindexter was above him. But I was thinking of somebody else who's a military guy. But yes, but
yeah, Poindexter was an admiral.
Was it? It began with an S, like Seward or Seward. Or something. But anyways,
Secord,
the three of them. Seacourt.
Admiral Seacourt.
Yes. Thank you, DJ. I knew you would know it.
Admiral Seaport would be far too ironic name.
But the three of them did, I think, some time to protect their president. I don't see that in this case. I do think maybe Flynn would do some time to protect his president. The rest of this gang, I don't see Manafort doing it. I don't see Kushner doing it. I don't see Roger Stone doing it. What do you guys think?
Kushner would not survive a day in prison. Kushner would cry like a baby.
I think he's already crying, but yeah.
You may be right on Kushner, but I certainly think that Manafort and Stone would definitely go to prison to protect their president. It just has to be President Putin, not President Trump.
You buttoned that.
No. So I think Trump's okay with those two for the wrong reasons. But yet, Kushner, I don't see Kushner. I see Kushner cracking. I certainly think that would be possible. I think that the big thing about this, though, and I know I've said this over and over again, is we have to recognize that Russia did not become a bad actor just when it decided it didn't like Hillary Clinton. I mean, and this is something that drives me nuts from all the people who throw the whataboutisms and all the nonsense and the conspiracy idiocies and that crazy thing in The Nation about nobody can do 180 megabits per second when my local internet company can do 300 megabits per second for business customers. The fact of the matter is, you know, Donald Trump could be pure as the driven snowflake on this particular issue. It doesn't mean Russia didn't carve up the Ukraine. It doesn't mean Russia hasn't propped up Bashar Assad as he's killed hundreds of thousands of his own people. It doesn't mean Russia didn't try to assassinate Montenegro's prime minister because he wanted to be part of NATO. And it doesn't change the fact that Donald Trump has essentially turned the other cheek in a disastrous way while Vladimir Putin has gotten away with just about all of this. Okay. Donald Trump may not be a criminal in his dealings with Russia, but he has made tremendous mistakes in his dealings with Russia. He has acted against American interests because he doesn't know what they are. That's the problem. Even if he is not guilty of collusion regarding the election, he is guilty of horribly bad foreign policy regarding Moscow, and that in and of itself is enough to justify his de-election in 2020.
Well, and I agree that I find it very far-fetched that we would find collusion in the Trump campaign between Trump campaign and Russia. I don't think enough people within the Trump campaign knew campaign law well enough to find ways to violate it. That doesn't mean they wouldn't try if they run again in 2020, but I think they were winging it and we've seen mistakes, but I don't think we've seen malfeasance. However, I think that everybody, Trump, Kushner, Manafort, Page, Flynn, all of them have had dealings with Russian entities in the past that if they are not actually criminal, they are borderline criminal. And we're going to see a whole lot of evidence of money laundering, of violations of the Foreign Agent Registry Act, of, you know, just shady dealings with really scuzzy Russian people that are going to tarnish this whole crew pretty badly.
I agree. And, you know, I want to ask lastly, Helena, you haven't weighed in on this. And because you've had such an active summer and you haven't been on the podcast for several weeks now, so much has happened in the Russian investigation since you last weighed in. I'm wondering, has anything changed in your perception of whether there is any there?
Gosh. So look, there's something there. There's definitely something there. I agree with the assessment that I don't think it was willful, and it depends on what the mens rea requirement is for the statutes, that, they would be prosecuted under. There's certain levels of knowledge that a person has to have to find them guilty of certain activity. I don't think that most of the actors here, with a couple exceptions, were aware of what they were doing. So you may have trouble meeting that. That being said, you know, you have to start to wonder, to what extent, what's it going to take for Trump to just go away, you know, for him to just say, it's not worth it anymore. Try and leave on a high note before things get too serious, before, you know, his communications department has to battle this on a daily basis. And I don't know. And also for McConnell and Paul Ryan to start really pushing in that direction, because they're acting with the efficiency of an opposition party, and they're not an opposition party, and it's his fault. So I keep waiting for the shoe to drop with this, and for the party to finally dismantle this disaster of an administration and try to move forward.
The United States, the only country with two opposition parties.
Right.
So on that note, I'm going to say thank you for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast, and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast, and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. And if you like political debate and would like to join us between shows, we're all in a Facebook group called Open Fire Politics. We're all there. We'd love to see you there too. So until next week, when we might be broadcasting from some mountainous area far outside of the cities and reporting on the aftermath of World War III, any last words?
I was at the beach all week. Yeah, I was at the beach all week. So this has been a real crash landing back into reality. Suddenly, you know, we're having World War III and there are Nazis marching in the streets of America. And, you know, I was eating ice cream with sand between my toes. This reality sucks.
Okay. And everybody remember, duck and cover, duck and cover.